almost feel entitled to sing back home again in Indiana. I'm glad to be here. When I was campaigning across Indiana in 2008 for Hillary, I went to so many places, I thought I was going to get a state tax bill. I want to first acknowledge the presence in the audience of a couple of people, beginning with John Gregg's running mate, Senator Vi Simpson. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you. Congressman Andre Carson, thank you for being here. Former Congressman Barron Hill. My great friend Judy O'Bannon, thank you for being here. Your great party chairman, Dan Parker, thanks for everything you do. And Mayor Tom McDermott of Hammond, Indiana, thank you for a lot of things that you and I know about, standing up, among other things, for the right to vote, the rule of law, and all the good stuff. Thank you for what you've done. And we have four good candidates for Congress here: Dave Crooks, Brendan Mullen, Shelley Yoder, and in this district, Representative Scott Reske. Thank you, and thank you for your service in the Marine Corps. Thank you all for being here. I'd like to thank the folks at North Central High School for making us welcome. We walked up here on the stage, and Joe and John and Evan looked at me and said, "Bill, this is about as good as we can do for a crowd here, except at a basketball game." I said, "I'd take that." Look, folks, I am really honored to be here. And I want to talk to you a little bit seriously. I didn't expect to be quite so involved in this campaign. I have now a daughter who's working for a television network and a wife who's got one of only two jobs in the government, the other being the Secretary of Defense, that are prohibited from participating in electoral politics. So you're stuck with me. But I want to say, I'm very grateful for the warm reaction you gave when Hillary's name was mentioned. I went down to Washington, and I got to stay last night in Washington, so when I got up this morning, she said, "I wish I were going with you, but you know I can't." I was there last night because we were celebrating our 37th wedding anniversary. And I remember when we got married, we were both, as I remember, making $16,500 a year, living in a house that cost $20,500, had 1,100 square feet, no air conditioning, $174 a month mortgage. I paid 20% down on it, I think, maybe a little more. But my life has been graced by the American dream. Only two governors of small states have ever been elected president. The other was Franklin Pierce, the governor of New Hampshire in 1852. And I got to know people like Evan Bay, whom I adore. He and Susan and their boys I've known since they were born. And I wanted to hate Evan Bay. Because when I was elected governor, I was the youngest person elected in 40 years, and he's 11 years younger than I am and a lot better looking, and he got elected younger than I did. I was really steamed about it. But a funny thing happens to you when you get older, and you realize And I'm not being morbid here. I've already outlived all the men in my family going back. You have to go to my maternal great-grandfather to find a man who's lived as long as I already have. I am not morbid. I am grateful. But when you know you have more yesterdays than tomorrow, it sort of simplifies and clarifies life. And I think about all that matters is whether people are better off when you quit than when you started, whether children have a brighter future, and whether things are coming together or being torn apart. The rest of it's all background music. And the question is, the question is, how do you get that? Now, if you look at what's made America great, what built the great middle class in the 20th century, it was clearly an economic philosophy that said, if you build a middle class and you give poor people an honorable, dignified way to work their way into it, if you help people who through no fault of their own can't get along in life, if you try to make sure people get a decent wage and can earn a decent income and support a family, the economy will go quicker and you'll reward the entrepreneurs and the creators, and there'll be more millionaires and billionaires, and we'll all be happy about it. One of the greatest things about America is we don't resent other people's success, as long as they're not being unfair about it. We like them. And so what do we learn from all that? That basically an economy of shared prosperity is better than one that starts with the theory that it'll all trickle down. What else do we learn? We learn that a philosophy of we're all in this together works a lot better than you're on your own. I'm going to tell you something, folks. Every time a kid leaves this school without a degree, every time a young person in Indiana has to drop out of college because of the debt, it constrains the economic opportunity and the growth potential of everybody else in the entire state. We are not on our own. And so, that means that the most successful countries, and I went to 72 when I was president, I've been to way more than 100 since I left office. I work in places now helping farmers who farm as little as a quarter acre of land. I've been down rural roads. It literally took me an hour and a half to go 12 miles. So once in a while, I still go to a presidential palace. But I like to be out in the country where I get my hands dirty. And here's what I know. Here's what I know. Everywhere in the world and everywhere in America that people are doing well, it's because government and business work together. And often they work with groups like my foundation is now, this whole civil society, non-governmental sector. But cooperation and honorable compromise work better than constant conflict. They just work better. This deal that's being presented to us by the group that now controls the Republican Party doesn't work very well. And every time they've run it out in the last 20 years, it hadn't worked very well. And I frankly resent the fact that it's called conservative, because it's not. The four people, I promise you, the four people on this stage, we are way more fiscally conservative than the people they got running for president, vice president, and every other office. Because, as I said in Charlotte, we believe in arithmetic. And really, people ask me all the time, How'd you produce four balanced budgets, four surpluses, and actually, the balanced budget is pretty easy because you got rid of 90% of the debt in the 4 years we were whittling it down. But I said, you know, the arithmetic. I was, you know, from Arkansas, and nobody had told me that when I went to Washington, 2 and 2 wasn't 4 anymore. And I can't figure out how they get called conservative. If you look at what Joe's opponent said, I loved everything about Indiana's role in the Senate when you had Evan Bayh and Richard Lugar. Because, and Evan will tell you, now, Dick Lugar was a bona fide conservative. He thought a lot of stuff ought to be done at the state and local level or in the private sector, and that I thought the federal government ought to help in. He voted against me more than half the time. But when the interests of the country were on the line, we got together and we worked together. And when I saw this primary and Joe's race unfolding, where Senator Lugar's opponent was excoriating him for working with President Obama on national security matters, you really think that it's a Republican or a Democratic issue whether Osama bin Laden and a lot of the leadership of al-Qaeda is gone now or not? I thought that was an American issue. I want to tell you something. When these people come home, great news about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq is a lot of people lived through them who never lived through any armed conflict in history because battlefield medicine is so much better. The bad news is about 300,000 of them have varying degrees of brain injuries because they were hurt by these IEDs, what you call roadside bombs, and they have terrible percussive effects, and your brain's fairly fragile, and it rattles around, and then things aren't like they were before. I have no idea how many Democrats and Republicans are in that 300,000 group, but I know this, we owe it to them to do everything we can to give them a chance to start their lives again. Why? How in God's name? So, some Republican came up to me and said, you know, Bill, I got a better idea here. You know, we could do this kind of outpatient service, and we could serve more people for less money and have higher impact. We could ask every person with skills in this area, in all the medical personnel in America, would they just give us 2 hours a week of volunteer time until we at least had a comprehensive inventory and we knew what everything did. I wouldn't give a rip if the guy was a conservative, a liberal, a Democrat, a Republican, a libertarian. I wouldn't care, and you wouldn't either. What is this idea that it's my way or the highway? Let me tell you. I tell everybody all the time. I was raised to believe that nobody's right all the time. Now, maybe Mr. Murdoch is, I don't know. He's way right all the time, I know that. But I was raised to believe that. And as I said, you know, a broken clock's right twice a day. So nobody's wrong all the time either. And the rest of us, we spend all of our fleeting lives between those two extremes. We know we're not going to be right all the time. We hope to goodness we're going to be right more than twice a day. Don't you think? So the idea that the government of the United States, facing the aftermath of a horrible financial meltdown, which went all over the whole world, and which is holding us back now, not just because of problems in America, but because of slow growth in Europe. Even the Chinese now are deliberately slowing their economy down because they're scared to death they're about to have the same kind of banking collapse we did. that somehow there is some theory untethered to any facts that we can force down the throat of every American who disagrees that will poof, magically make it all right. It's just not so. It ain't so. And the idea that Indiana, a state that sent Evan Bayh and Dick Lugar to the United States Senate, would send somebody up there to say it's my way or the highway, to say that there's no constitutional basis for Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, is unbelievable to me. And especially if they don't believe in arithmetic. They kind of let the cat out of the bag last night. I don't know if you watched that debate, but one of the things, you know, I kind of sympathize with Congressman Ryan. He's got to defend now Governor Romney's position that the $716 billion in Medicare savings in the president's budget that the congressman voted for is somehow a ripoff, even though it was in his budget too. And there's a reason, because it wasn't a cut. It was people saying the truth. They brought in all these doctors and all these folks. The American Medical Association endorsed it. The AARP endorsed it. Do you really think they'd be out in the business of wrecking Medicare? You think all the old geezers like me would still pay their AARP dues if they thought the AARP was wrecking Medicare? I mean, come on, give me a break here. So, but he's got to stand up there with a straight face and say all that stuff. Look, here's the deal. I'm going to say this one more time. A program called Medicare Advantage was started under President Bush. The idea was that if you wanted to, you could get an insurance company to give you preventive care and services as well as regular Medicare. To get the insurance companies into it, when they started, they paid them $1,100 to give $600 worth of services. Well, you'd do nearly anything but rob a bank for that kind of markup, wouldn't you? Right? So beginning when President Bush was in office and the Republicans were in a majority, they started, as people enrolled, they started whittling down the profit margin, because they realized that as soon as people saw they could afford to give these preventive services and people stayed healthier and the cost stayed down, you couldn't justify wasting the taxpayers' money on that kind of profit margin. So they got some new recommendations, which, as I said, the AARP endorsed, which said there's enough people in this now, we can cut this profit margin down to about $1.14 for every dollar you spend on regular Medicare. And in fairness, the people that started said eventually it ought to be exactly the same, because you should have your people healthier and less costly. So we're getting toward that, right? That's all they did. And when you cut the profit margin down that much, you still got a lot of business in Indiana killed for a guaranteed 14% profit every single day, every single month, every single year from now to the end of time. Now, that's all this deal is. But in everybody's budget before, they assume the higher cost. Once you say you're not going to spend that $716 billion, it keeps Medicare alive till 2024. Now, if you do that, then all these radical changes these guys are proposing in privatizing it become unnecessary, because it gives us more than a decade to see whether we can bring health care costs overall down to the rate of inflation. If we do, we won't have to do those radical things, because health care costs in the private sector have gone up way more than Medicare costs have. What you have to do is bring health care costs down to the rate of inflation. We're getting, and by the way, in the last 2 years, health care costs have been under 4% 2 years in a row for the first time, and listen to this, 50 years. So, That's the deal. So the idea that Joe Donnelly was out there ripping off Medicare is not so. You ought to be glad that he said, we're not going to spend that money where it would be a waste of your money, and instead we're going to use it to close the donut hole in the drug program. That'll save $600 for seniors. And to help provide affordable health insurance for more than 30 million Americans with pre-existing conditions who do not have it now. Let me just say one or two other things about this Senate race while I'm on it. I don't understand how you could say your biggest thrill in life is to impose your opinion on somebody else. Especially if you don't necessarily know what you're talking about. And I don't mean that arrogantly. Really. And I don't mean that in a hateful way, but if you're an ideologue as opposed to a practical person, those Indiana Hoosier common sense thing, the difference, common sense means you look at the facts, you talk it over, you listen to everybody else, you find the smartest people you can, you sit down, do what seems to make common sense. If you're an ideologue, right, if you say, what Washington needs is more partisanship, that's what he said. What Washington needs is less compromise. I saw him say that after he defeated Senator Lugar. I thought he at least might have acknowledged that Dick Lugar made this country a safer, stronger place for 30 years and not be so ungracious. And so he said, and that's when I called Evan and I said, Evan, I believe Joe Donnelly can win this race. Because I don't believe the people of Indiana think what this country needs in Washington, D.C. is more partisanship. We got plenty of that already. We need practical, common sense, shared solutions. Now, I feel the same way about state government. You know, it'll be like a cold shower for Congressman Pence if he were to become governor. Because in the state government, you don't have an option, arithmetic rules. And you can't not pass bills. You can't get reelected like you can to Congress. Apparently, you can get reelected a dozen years and never pass a bill. You can't do that when you're governor. You've got to actually pass a bill. And it really hurts if you say that the minimum wage is a violation of free market economics. Let me tell you, I've heard that every time I raised it, as governor and as president. And every time I did it, the economy got stronger. Why? Because if good people are working too hard for too little and don't have enough to support their kids, it is a constraint on economic growth for everybody. It chokes off growth. I'll tell you something you're going to have to contend with in Indiana, because every state does now. Every state in the country is having trouble funding its university system and its community colleges and its vocational schools and its job training programs because revenues are tight and they're trying to hold on to the public schools. And if they've got really good sense, they're doing what my friend Mr. Gregg wants to do with early childhood education, which can dramatically increase the ability to learn for a lifetime. But here's something that ought to bother us all. And again, this is not a Republican or Democratic issue. At least I wouldn't think it would be. Keep in mind, Dwight Eisenhower signed the National Defense Education Act, and I got a loan from that to help me finish my education, and I was honored to pay it off. I don't think it was welfare. I don't think it was a waste of money. I think the country did a pretty good job investing in me and millions of other people, and I paid it off. But anyway, Dwight Eisenhower signed a bill to start the interstate highway system. I don't know about you, but I think it's a pretty good investment for the country. And it brought a lot of new industry to the middle of America and the heartland and enabled us to move goods in a way we never could do before. So I think that's important. But anyway, from the passage of the GI Bill through the 1990s, America always ranked first or second in the world in the percentage of our young people who had four-year college degrees. And it was a godsend for us. Now, keep in mind, not every job requires a college degree. But nearly every job in the 21st century will be created by somebody who has one. In technology, in biotechnology, and, you know, all these new petroleum and natural gas engineers that figure out how to design this equipment so we can work it without wrecking the water table, and all the things that have to be done, and these new technologies that the Secretary of Energy says are going to bring solar power down to 6 cents a kilowatt hour within just a few years. It's dropped 70% in 3 years. All these things are happening. Meanwhile, what happened in the last decade? We dropped from second to 16th in the world in the percentage of our young people with four-year degrees, and we're still nearly first in the percentage of our young people who go to college. What does that tell you? People are scared they can't pay the bills. Now, there's a very interesting thing. This applies to the governor's office and to the Senate race. One of the most important bills passed by the Congress and signed by the president revises the student loan law, and it's kind of like this Medicare deal. It takes the $60 billion in subsidies, $60 billion of the subsidies that we were paying banks to make loans, and saves the money by letting the government have a loan reserve, and let's say the University of Indiana certifies all the kids that are eligible for student loans. And they get the loans direct at a lower interest rate. But more important than the lower interest rate, now for the first time, everybody in America that gets a student loan has an absolute right, if they choose, to pay that loan back as a low fixed percentage of their income for up to 20 years. Now, what does this mean? This is a really big deal. Every young person and every parent who's worried sick about paying for college ought to vote for Joe Donnelly for the United States Senate for this reason alone. Now listen to me. What does this mean? It means that nobody ever has to drop out of school again. And it means that when you get out of school, if you want to be a teacher or a police officer, or if you got a big bill from graduating from medical school, but you want to go out to rural Indiana and do family and community practice for a few years, you can do it because your loan repayment will be determined by your income, not the other way around. This is a huge deal. Governor Romney and Mr. Ryan and the whole Republican movement is committed to repealing this. This is not conservative. Dwight Eisenhower signed the National Defense Education Act. This is not conservative. It is not conservative not to nourish your human resources. It is not conservative to pay money to subsidize something that doesn't need it. When we did this, Evan voted for it, we did this on a volunteer basis when I was president. The students saved $9 billion. Now that was, that doesn't mean anything. The students saved $1,300 in repayment costs on every $10,000 they borrowed. That's real money, right? And The taxpayers saved $4 billion because once kids could repay their loans, they all did it. They were honorable. They didn't default anymore. This is going to revolutionize this problem. This means people don't have to drop out anymore. They want to repeal it. And, oh, let me tell you what they did with the $60 billion. This is pay-as-you-go. They took the $60 billion and used it to fund graduated increases in Pell Grants and to keep the tax credits for tuition for a decade. That's what they did with the savings. Now, what is his opponent's position? What is their position from top to bottom? We're going to repeal that law, give the $60 billion back to the banks and subsidies, make the loans more expensive, make them harder to repay, increase the dropout rate, cut the Pell Grants, and put the funding of the tuition tax credits in danger. I don't think this is a close question. That's another reason Joe Donnelly should be sent to Congress, to the Senate, by Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and everybody else. I don't think it's a close question. Now, let me just say one last thing that references what John Gregg talked about. When you get to be governor, especially in a time like this, pretty quick you figure out your job is schools and jobs. It's education and jobs. That works out, everything else. Then you got money to deal with the human services problems, and you can balance a budget, and if you got tax problems, you can deal with them. In my opinion, the best thing that the president and the administration has done is the auto deal. And I never call it a bailout. Let me just tell you what. I grew up, my dad had a little independent Buick dealership. In the 1950s, when I was 6 years old, I was on my back under a car getting grease on my face. That's back when a real human being could fix a car, you know, it's all computerized now. And when Mr. Ryan said last night that Governor Romney was a car guy, I thought, well, if having an elevator stack him counts, I guess he was. But let me tell you something about this car thing. It was not a bailout. It was a restructuring that we as taxpayers participated in because the banks were unwilling to save the automobile companies. And so we didn't just give them the money. There were management gives backs, there were labor gives backs, there were improvements in how the supply chain was going to work. And the most interesting thing of all is, though General Motors and Chrysler got the money, the bailout, as they call it, or the restructuring, as I call it, was supported by the other car manufacturers, including the Japanese companies and the German companies with factories in America. Why? Because they knew if General Motors went down, it was bye-bye to the auto parts suppliers. And they knew they couldn't supply them either. It's another example of how we're all in this together. So, yeah, you had 120,000 jobs at stake in Indiana. But there were more than 1 million people in auto parts supply business and in the supply chain whose jobs were on the line in local dealerships. So what happened when we acted like we were all in this together? There are now, all those jobs are saved, there are now 250,000 more people working, making cars than there were the day the bill was signed, and auto sales last month reached a four-year high. That's another reason that you should vote for John Gregg. So, John Gregg's opponent voted against it, and Joe Donnelly's opponent tried to kill it in court. You got to give them credit. They didn't just speak out against it. I mean, they took a real stand. They said, let's put those suckers out of work as quick as we can. And if you think that's the way America ought to work, then you should support them. But the truth is, again, I'm telling you, I go all over the world. I do this work everywhere. Every successful country supports manufacturing with a government-private partnership. Everybody does. Every country in the world finds some way to support manufacturing. Because we started doing that again, we now have 500,000 more manufacturing jobs than we did just 3 years ago. And manufacturing is growing again in America for the first time since the 1990s. I think it's the right decision. So, anyway, that's my deal. Constructive cooperation works better than constant conflict. Shared prosperity works better than trickle down. We're all in this together works better than you're on your own. It's what works. If you apply Hoosier common sense to this election, you will elect John Gregg governor, and you will elect Joe Donnelly to the United States Senate. And I think that's exactly what you're going to do. Thank you. God bless you all.